Morning, everyone. Is the mic working? Can you hear me clearly? Okay. First of all, before we even start, someone asked me to mention that there is a white Grand Marquis outside that has its lights on. So if it belongs to anyone, now's the time to go and turn them off. It is my great pleasure to welcome all of you to the first Women's Day of Learning of the Rebbetzin Frida K. Hermes Women's Institute of Torah. It is very gratifying to see how many of you have come to join us today for what promises to be an invigorating and informative program. I am honored to be here standing in front of you, in front of this audience, which is so obviously committed both to learning Torah and to personal spiritual growth. Each of you came here today with a desire to learn and to be inspired, and truthfully, by your presence here, you are an inspiration to other people, so I thank you. It is our hope that you will enjoy this program to its fullest. And before we start the program, I have a few announcements to make. First of all, the one that is the most gratifying to us is to tell you that today's program is sold out, which is something we had hoped for, and our expectations were met. And now a few technical things. All of you were given tickets at registration. If you don't have one, you should have one. I want to tell you a couple of things about it. You should see listed under your name that you are registered for workshops, and those are the workshops that you really do need to attend. You need to go to the ones to which you are assigned, because there is limited seating in the rooms where they're being held. The second thing is that you will see a star on some of your tickets. Those of you who have registered for lunch will have a star on the ticket, and this is the indication that there is a reservation for you. Now, if you have any questions about where to go during the course of the day, look for those of us, the chairman or the hostesses, who have a flower on our name card. You can identify us that way, and we'll be happy to direct you wherever you're going. I don't have the program here, but just to let you know, there are a couple of things that might make it easier for you. Thank you. For the first workshop, as soon as the panel discussion is over, this is the Preakness North. So if your workshop is being held in Preakness North, you're already here. Everything else, in order to get to the rooms where you're going, you need to go back down the hall where you entered, turn to your left, and all of those workshops are being held there, with the exception of one which is on the second floor boardroom. You turn to the right to get to the elevators, and that will take you up to the second floor. But again, if you have any questions, then ask any one of the hostesses, and they will be able to help you. For those of you who would like tapes of the sessions that you have attended, or tapes of the sessions which you cannot attend because you can't be in two places at once, we will be taping the sessions. Tapes will be available at the end of the sessions and throughout the day at the tables outside these doors, and we ask that you not use your own taping equipment, because we will be making these available for you. They will be, certainly all of them will be ready at 4 o'clock at the end of the day. They're $5 a piece, and order forms are also going to be out in case you want to order something that you won't be here for, or if you haven't ordered it, or if you haven't picked it up during the day. The last thing that I want to tell you is that we have a very full program packed into the day, and we know that you want to gain as much as possible from this intensive day of learning. We respect not only your determination to be here, but also your desire to leave on time. And so we ask that you try to move along quickly, because we are very tightly scheduled. So when we ask you to move from one part of the program to the other, it's because we want you to get as much out of it as possible. Now, on to the program. As you know, the theme of the day is Yisrael Bein Ha'amim, Yisrael among the nations, with the goal of understanding and appreciating our unique mission. First on our schedule is the panel discussion entitled, Why Do They Say Those Things About Us? Evaluating and Redeeming Our Reputation. I would like to introduce to you the distinguished members of the panel who will be addressing this issue. First of all is Rabbi Yitzchak Breidowitz, who is the rabbi of Woodside Synagogue Ahavas Torah in Silver Spring, Maryland, and also the professor of law in the University of Maryland. Next is Rabbi Abba Cohn, the director and counsel of Agudath Israel of America in the Washington office. And next is Rabbi Larry Ziffer, vice president for community development, the Associated Jewish Community Federation of Baltimore. And I will now hand the program over to Rabbi Ziffer to begin the panel presentation.
Good morning. Thank you, Elaine. I'd like to start with a little disclaimer. I'm a happy Orthodox professional. I'm going to say some things that may upset you, but I'd like you to listen carefully and stick with me through my presentation. Those who know me well know that my personal behavior and my religious perspectives are certainly strictly Orthodox. But what I'm going to say to you this morning may surprise you. Let me start by telling you over a vignette. Over 20 years ago, I was a student in graduate school at the Wurzweiler School of Social Work in New York City. New York City is a wonderful place to be Jewish. You encounter a lot of different kinds of people and different kinds of Judaism. And a colleague of mine, a student in the graduate school, had graduated from the Jewish Theological Seminary. And he said to me, you know, if the Rambam were alive today, he'd be teaching at JTS. And I said, what are you talking about? How could you say such a thing? And he said, well, you know, here's what really happened. During the Enlightenment period in the 1700s, the Orthodox were far from the Orthodox community was skew off from the norm, because as a reaction to the Enlightenment, they went way far away from the Jewish tradition of being flexible and accommodating the times. And so when we veered off to the right, we began the creation of a new religion that lacked the vitality and flexibility that had always characterized Judaism in the diaspora. So he described to me the fact that conservative Judaism came along to conserve the Jewish tradition in its former character of adapting to the needs of the particular times. That set me to thinking, because it began a process of reflection on how others see us, and I began listening more carefully to the things that people say about us. We usually evaluate such statements from our perspective and not from the perspective of those who are making the statements to us. We assume that they're not sincere, and they're obviously anti-Orthodox if they're critical of us, when in fact, they see themselves as being quite sincere and objective. So what are the conclusions that I've reached, given 23 years of working in the general Jewish community in the Federation world, working and sharing concerns and perspectives with many non-Orthodox Jews? So let me ask you a few questions about us. What makes us think that we have the exclusive truth? What gives us the chutzpah, or how do we have the chutzpah to tell others in the community what to do when we don't participate as much in that larger community? I'll give you a corollary. Here in Baltimore, the Orthodox people, the Orthodox community, receives far more in the way of benefits and support from the rest of the organized Jewish community than we contribute, and far more proportionately than any other specific movement. And yet, we presume to tell others what to do with the resources they allocate to us. Let me ask you a question. Where in Jewish law does it mandate that we have to have such large families? Don't we realize that we're creating a mini welfare state in the Orthodox community? Then what happens is we teach our kids to shun higher education, which means that our families typically earn less money. They have trouble paying tuitions. They require more scholarships. They create additional strains on our schools and the school's ability to pay the teachers, who are in large part our own people who are the teachers. This also makes it more difficult for us to support our own institutions, much less the Associated and the Federation, creating even more financial stress. So consequently, what happens? The fundraisers for our Orthodox organizations need to go to the non-Orthodox community, asking them to contribute, telling them that they're not Orthodox enough, but their money is. To top it all off, we then turn to the Associated, the Federation, which we don't support, and we scream that they're not giving enough support to day schools, where, to add insult to injury, our children are being educated to shun participation in the larger community. And they surely won't grow up to support the Associated. Another question. Don't we realize that promoting our views to the exclusion of others is equivalent to the tyranny of the minority? Give you an example. 4 years ago, I'm sure most of you remember, when the Orthodox community took great efforts to make sure that the Owings Mills JCC stayed closed on Shabbos. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. Question: if our people are so sure that we are right, why is there so much disagreement among our own people? Obviously, we are so fractious and obstinate in our parochial views that we can't even come together around important issues. We have many more subgroups, more synagogues, more schools than the other movements have, indicating that we can't even get along together in order to save our resources and achieve some kind of economy of scale. And if living the religious life is so right and so important and valuable and necessary, shouldn't the point be that it makes you a better person? How do we account for all of those scandals in the Orthodox community in which Orthodox leaders are found to be embezzling money, engaging in inappropriate sexual behavior, and so forth? How is it that we can be so totally oblivious of the rest of the world when we walk through our neighborhoods on Shabbos? Where do we walk? In the streets, as if we own them. Doesn't it occur to us that we're creating a safety hazard for ourselves and for others? I mean, this is not Bayit Vegan, after all. Now for a confession. Those are not my views. But you knew that. They are the perspectives that I've heard at one time or another from some people who are incredibly dedicated to the welfare of the Jewish community. People who donate hundreds of hours of their time, as well as their charitable support, to their own synagogues, organizations like the Associated, and other community institutions, many of which do in fact benefit members of our Orthodox Jewish community. Why do they have these negative stereotypes? There are a few reasons. One is obviously that they have some amount of guilt about not being more religious. That's clearly one reason. But not everybody feels that way. Another is the genuine feeling that we don't practice what we preach. Nothing in the world could be more damaging than hypocrisy, or even the perception of hypocrisy in the eyes of non-Orthodox people. That's obviously why Chazal put so much emphasis on their concerns about Chilul Hashem, Maris Ayin, not to mention the general principle of Mipnei Darkei Sholom, which in many instances enables us to do certain things because of the way we're seen in the eyes of others. Now, there is a kernel of truth in each of the statements that I made to you. In fact, many of you have probably had conversations about some of these points with your family or your guests over the Shabbos table. In point of fact, we Orthodox Jews are incredibly self-critical. We know that there are soft spots in our armor. Our institutions are in need of financial support, and it's not clear how we're going to sustain them. We know that there are situations like the Shidduch scene which have somehow gone awry, and we're not quite sure how to fix them. We are pained by the seemingly petty squabbles that seem to preoccupy some of our institutions and our subgroups. Often these differences have nothing to do with ideology, but instead revolve around personalities of individuals who lead these organizations and institutions and who are certain that only their way is correct. However, we hate it when these criticisms come from the outside. What we need to do is to cultivate the ability to see ourselves and our relationships with other Jews through their eyes. In my opinion, there are two main differences between our Judaism and their Judaism. And I use that term advisedly because I'm taking the liberty to assume that in this room you understand where I'm coming from. Because I do work in the general community and I have incredibly strong and powerful and effective relationships with many very caring non-Orthodox Jews. Of course, there are more than two differences, and I'm not even going to touch on profound halachic differences and problems with non-Orthodox versions of Judaism, but I want you to think about these two differences. First of all, for us, Judaism is constant. When asked what our religion is, we'll answer Jewish, and that answer is necessary, but it's certainly not sufficient. Our Jewishness suffuses our lives. For most non-Orthodox Jews, their Judaism is episodic. They may care deeply about their religion, their heritage, their ethnic associations, but in their eyes, they see us as just being over-obsessed with our Jewishness. They don't understand how it is that we could put so much emphasis on what they consider to be minutiae, little details of daily living. And they don't like to be made to feel that they're any less Jewish just because they're not Orthodox or just because they don't think about it all the time. Second, let me return to my statement about the Rambam being alive today and the sincerity with which my colleague said that to me. We need to recognize that their convictions, as episodic as they might be, are often within a context that they believe is totally valid. They don't seek our validation, and then we shouldn't imply that we're offering validation. You know, historically, Orthodox rabbis have resisted participating in forums with non-Orthodox rabbis precisely because of the impression that we would be conveying to them the sense that we consider them to be rabbis. They don't care. They don't need our haskama. They're not seeking our haskama. But from their point of view, it's not just about us being serious and them being casual. They just have a different set of values. So no matter what we may say, based on our superior knowledge, our knowledge of Torah, our knowledge of what Yiddishkeit really is, or our sense of commitment, they're just not going to defer to us simply because we're convinced that we're right. What's the point? I believe that each of us is an emissary. Positive impressions of Orthodox Jews and Orthodox Jewish lifestyle do an enormous amount of good. Each of us, without realizing it, is in the kiruv business, and it's not just about making people frum. I believe that when the ultimate din v'cheshbon is taken, we in the Orthodox community will be held accountable for every lost opportunity to demonstrate that derachecha darchei noam v'chol nesivoseha shalom, that we're going to be looked to as to how we behaved, how we comported ourselves, whether we were sufficiently aware of our interactions with non-Orthodox Jews and the impressions that we leave, and whether those impressions gave people a sense of the beauty and the sweetness of Yiddishkeit, or whether they reinforced stereotypes that people already have of people who put all their emphasis on details and not enough on the big picture. More to follow in the questions and answers, but I hope that that was helpful to you in setting a tone for today's discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here and to raise some questions, to raise some issues about Jews in the world of politics, which is the vantage point from which I come. And it's appropriate because politics is kolel hakol. It talks about issues, it talks about relationships, pressures, and you learn a lot from how the Jewish community behaves, what place the Jewish community has within the world of politics. By the way, Larry, I wish you wouldn't have started with the disclaimer about being a happy Jewish professional. It sort of puts me on the spot. Take that out of the recording, please. Yes. Whenever I talk about Jews in the world of politics, I'm reminded of a parable. The parable is brought down in Parshas Vayelech. And I think it describes well the kind of situation that we find ourselves in. The Parsha talks about Hester Panim. And it describes a situation of ra'os, rabos, v'tzaros. There will be many ra'os, many evil things happening, v'tzaros that will aggravate one another. And the Das Keni Balei HaTosfos writes, kagon, for example, zibura v'yakrava, like a bee and a scorpion. Shemayim tzonanim ma'alei la'kitzas devorim. Cold water helps for bee stings. Umayim chamim, and warm water, lakitzas akrav. And warm water helps for scorpion stings. V'chilufa sakanta, but if you switch it around, if you give the wrong water to the bee or the wrong water to the scorpion, it's a sakana. So, misha okzo zibura v'akrava, eino yodea malasos. If somebody is bitten, if someone is stung by both a bee and a scorpion, they don't know what to do. If they put cold water on it, it will help the bee sting, but it will aggravate the scorpion sting. And if they put warm water, it will help the scorpion sting, but it will aggravate the bee sting. And that's sort of the dilemma, the constraining situation we find ourselves often in the world of politics. Politics, by their nature, is very delicate, very complex. And when we decide to get involved in an issue, the positions we take, the relationships that we develop with others in the political world, those things have to be carved out with surgical precision. And if you do one thing in one area, it has implications and ramifications in the other area, sometimes positive and sometimes negative. Which issues do we get involved in once we decide to get involved in an issue? With how loud a voice do we speak? What about other considerations, other communities, other implications in other areas of politics? For example, the organized community, in the Orthodox community, has traditionally been in favor of vouchers. We know it will help our schools. At the same time, there are very serious church-state concerns that we have to worry about as well. We have to balance those two things. We have to make judgments. Civil rights issues. Of course, we care about our religious rights. We care about our rights in the workplace. But what about problems in the realm of civil rights that relate to gay rights, that relate to affirmative action? Again, we have to balance those two things. There are those who argue that in abortion, we shouldn't even get involved at all. And yet the Orthodox community has spoken out on that particular issue. These are very delicate questions, very complex in how we approach them and how we answer them. How are we perceived in the political world? Well, around 12 years ago, my office opened. It was the first office, first Orthodox office in Washington. And a lot of people looked on to see whether we would fall on our face. Does the Orthodox community have the political culture to be able to operate a full-time legislative office? Since that time, the Orthodox Union has opened an office, Lubavitch has opened an office, and we've done quite well. We've been welcomed, we've been accepted, we've been invited to participate in the political process. Now, if one would be cynical, and believe me, there's always room for cynicism when it comes to politics, we would say, well, they've welcomed us because they want our votes. They want our money. And partly, of course, that's true. But we, I think, are of value to them for other reasons as well. First of all, we have shattered the myth of a monolithic Jewish community. There was always this notion that the Jewish community, as it existed over the decades, thought with one mind and spoke with one voice. And in many respects, that was true. But now the Orthodox come onto the scene with a different perspective, with a different way of going about doing things. And that's a value to a politician. That's a value to a political leader. The fact, and it's a value to us. It makes our presence there more valuable to the politician and for the causes that we care about. There's another issue, and that is that I think they see in us a level of consistency and more so reliability that they might not see in the normal, quote-unquote, political world. What I mean by that is that I think more than support for issues, a political leader cares about whether he or she can count on you or not. Whether you're in or you're out, that's a different issue. But if we can rely on you, if we can count on you, if we know where you stand, if you don't change with the political winds, if you don't flip-flop on issues, then we value that. And knowing that our community is rooted in a set of values, in a tradition, in a hashkafa, that guides us and directs the positions that we take on various issues, I think is something that they respect. Now, I would just make the larger point then, because it flows inevitably from this, that, I mean, people ask me all the time, I mean, how do you survive in the world of 3 martini lunches? You know, don't you have to compromise? Don't you have to do things that you really are uncomfortable doing? And the answer is no. In fact, I find that the opposite is true. The truer we are to the values that we espouse, the more respected we are, even in political circles that you would think don't really understand those values that well. And I'm not being frum. There are too many people in this room that know me better than that. I'm not being frum. I'm talking about politics. Good politics dictates that we remain true to our values and our hashkafa. But the truth is, I think that if we look at it a little deeper, in terms of how we're perceived by the political world, we are mostly an enigma to them. And our insularity, our separateness, contribute to that sense of an enigma. And we see it sometimes in the positions we take. Again, I'll go back to the issue of abortion. You know, we are against abortion on demand, and yet we don't take positions on notification issues or 24-hour waiting periods. We want exceptions for life of the mother, right? For many in the conservative religious community, this is not quite understandable to them. They're coming from a different vantage point. And this goes back to what I said before. I mean, we carve out our positions according to our hashkafa. It's okay that we do this. This is nothing to be apologetic for. But it's something difficult, I think, for the larger political community, especially groups, conservative religious groups, that are looking to us as allies. I think it's difficult for them to understand those distinctions, and understandably so. And this leads me really to the second point, and this is a major issue for our community, and that's the issue of coalitions. You know, political work in Washington and elsewhere now is really accomplished through the mechanism of coalitions. The first thing a politician will ask you is, you know, you have your issue, it's a good issue, but how many people are on your side? How broad is the coalition? Who are they? We really have entered a period of coalitional politics. For an organization that is Torah-based, it presents all kinds of difficulties. For example, there's a bill that is intended to protect religious accommodation in the workplace. The Arab community here, they have their issues. They want to support that bill as well. They want to come into coalition with the Jewish community. Their support would help us, especially now since September 11th, when everybody seems to want to do something for the Muslim community. But the question is raised, how do we sit down with people, and I'm not lumping all Arab groups in this, but some of the Arab groups that have approached us, with people who support Hamas and Islamic Jihad? If they want to bomb your children, can you sit down with them on this particular issue, even though it has nothing to do with what's going on in Israel, and even though their support would be quite helpful? Or evangelicals who have gone on record as saying, we want to convert you. We want to convert your children. There are issues they could be very helpful to us on, especially in today's climate, today's White House, today's Congress. Do we sit down with them? Do we go into coalition with them? And even within the Jewish community, as was alluded to before. Religious Jewish organizations that are not Orthodox could be helpful. They have a very powerful lobby in Washington, a very good grassroots network to accomplish the things that we want, that are good for us. But does going into coalition with them, does it bring them credibility? Does it bring them legitimacy? Do we care about that? Does it matter whether it's a legal brief or whether it's a political coalition? Does it matter if there are 100 organizations that are on or whether there's 3 organizations that are on? These are the kinds of questions that have to be considered in deciding these kinds of issues. Because coalitional politics, again, is really the way things are done. There's one other issue. I really started developing this thought since September 11th. And a vort by Rav Soloveitchik really sparked it in me. He talks about the issue of Ger V'Toshav, that Avraham Avinu described himself as a Ger V'Toshav. And what he says is that we're Toshavim in the sense that we obey the laws of the country, we pay our taxes, we are patriotic, we support the government, we support the president, we are patriotic, we are nationalistic in that sense. But we are always Gerim. We're always Gerim because we're fighting the influences of society, we're fighting the cultural influence, the societal influences. And that's the lot of the Jew in the Golos. And it's an interesting insight because in a political sense, because you see with non-Jewish organizations, especially with the Christian right, they have melded together their religion and their sense of politics. Is it a Christian country? Well, Jerry Falwell certainly has a view on that. But we see it even in the Jewish community, because Tikkun Olam, which is the guiding force of, let's say, the reform movement, Tikkun Olam, is a quest for social justice. Much of their religion has been encapsulated in the notion of social justice. There you see the overlap between politics and religion. With us, we don't have that overlap as much. At least I don't see it as much. We have our status as a Toshav, but we also have our status as a Ger. I just mentioned the fact that, in terms of the Lieberman factor, I don't think the Lieberman factor really taught us much about Orthodoxy. It gave more publicity to Orthodoxy, but it really didn't do much in terms of explaining it and working out these kinds of issues. And I'll just leave that there. It's impossible not to talk about politics without talking about the Jewish community, because the Jewish community, the larger Jewish community, is so involved in politics, and much of its activity in the world is political in nature. It's really hard not to talk, give some mention of it. And our relationship with the larger Jewish community and political issues is very tender. It's a very tender relationship. Because a lot of the issues that we raise really strike at, if you'll excuse the expression, the orthodoxies of the larger Jewish community. Church-state relations, civil rights, abortion. This whole notion of tikkun olam, a social justice notion, is something that's become a civil religion to them. And we heard recently that Rabbi Yaffe, the leader of the Reform Movement, in commenting about vouchers and in commenting about the segment of the Jewish community supportive of vouchers, said that he was ashamed and embarrassed at those Jews who support vouchers. Now, aside from the substantive issue of vouchers, I mean, to talk about being ashamed and embarrassed really changes the tone and the texture of the debate and of the relationship between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox in the political world. I like to think it was always more civil than that. But that really was a very big blow. The Jewish community will say that we're self-interested, we only care about ourselves, and it's an issue, it's a question. Maybe we should care more about societal matters. We care about anti-Semitism, maybe we should care about racism and civil rights, social justice, criminal justice, and the environment, public education, social welfare. Maybe there is something to the fact that we should be more global, and again, if you'll excuse the expression, more Catholic in the approach that we have toward these issues. They also say that we like to use government for our own purposes, and the examples are our laws protecting the kashrus consumer, If we've got problems in the kashrus world, let's work it. Why don't you work them out yourselves? Get laws. If you have problems in the get laws, why can't the rabbis change the law? Why are you using the political system? And of course, vouchers. If you have problems paying your tuition, why are you using the political process? I just want to make one more comment, which was alluded to before. I think the darkest day in my career, and I've been doing Jewish political work for 16 years, was the day that I sat in a Senate, it was a Senate committee room, the Committee on Special Investigations, and the topic was the fraud of hundreds of millions of dollars by Jewish Orthodox institutions, whether it was Pell Grants or housing aid. And it was like being exposed to the world, because we had Senate investigators that were talking about Torah, and they were talking about mitzvos, and they were talking about learning, and they were talking about kolel, and they were talking about all the kinds of things that we cherish, but they were talking about them in somewhat of a prosecutorial manner. And there was something painful about sitting in the Senate of the United States and having these things discussed and the way that they were discussed. And there's just no excuse for it. I mean, we hear about, you know, our communities in economic crisis, or that in some parts of our community there's a different culture that has not quite acclimated to the American to American society. But there's no excuse, there's no explanation, and it has to stop. And we have to teach this in our schools. I just want to end up on one note. I think since September 11th, there's a new frontier for us. There was always discussions about good Jews and bad Jews, then they went into the good Orthodox and bad Orthodox, which was one of the things that came out of the Lieberman discussion. But now the issue is, who looks more like Osama bin Laden? And we've already read it in the papers. I mean, journalists like Thomas Friedman and Ellen Goodman have already talked about Jewish fundamentalists. Some of them don't even shake women's hands. And I think in terms of our challenge, not only in terms of society, but politically as well, that's going to be the next big challenge for us, to make the differentiation, which some have already made, but we have to continue to drive home this point that we can be religious, we can be ultra-Orthodox even, but we're not all Jewish fundamentalists that are wielding Kalashnikovs. And I think that's the biggest challenge for us, both in society as well as in politics. I hope I've raised some issues. I hope I've raised more questions than I've answered, and I appreciate you listening to me. Thank you very much.
Yes, the two speakers that have preceded me have addressed very eloquently the issues of being involved in the larger Jewish community and being involved in the political system. I'd like to address it, again, taking off on what both of them talked about, how we as individuals, who are not necessarily politically well-connected, nor are we involved institutionally in the greater community, what we do ourselves in terms of building bridges between religious, non-religious, and even to some degree between Jews and non-Jews. Looking at the title of the panel discussion, why do they say those things about us? The first question that appears is, who are they and who are us? And is there an us and is there a they? And is that the right way of visualizing the world? On one level, of course, all of us know who the they are and all of us know who the us is. The us are Achenu v'Achiyosenu, Bnei Yisrael, who are Naaman to Mesorah, who believe in mitzvos, who believe in Torah min Hashamayim, who want to pass those traditions down to our children, recognizing that this is what brings holiness into the world, And we ought to be proud of it. We ought to rejoice in it. We ought to be proud of it. If indeed there are some bad apples, which are awesome and terrifying examples of Chilul Hashem, obviously that does not represent the majority of Torah Jews. And it's very, very unfair. We don't find, for example, the Catholic Church being tarred because of a particular Catholic who might have been guilty of a scandal on Wall Street. So indeed, there is an us and there is a them, all of those who don't understand what Torah is about. And yet, we cannot deny the fact that there's something very pernicious and something very, very dangerous in creating those dichotomies. You know, we're going to be reading in these parshios, the parshios of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Jews were enslaved for 210 years in Mitzrayim. The Mekubalim tell us that the Jews had reached the 49th level of impurity. They should have been there 400 years. Hashem had to take them out right then, because if he would have left them there another minute, they didn't even have time to let their dough rise. They would have hit level number 50, whatever that means. They would have been irredeemable. They were not from, one could be sure. They were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. They were idol worshippers, except for Shevet Levi. They did not practice Bris Milah. So what deserving zechus did they have? Why were they deserving of redemption? The Gemara in Sota tells us they didn't change their names. They didn't change their language. They didn't speak Lashon Hara about each other in terms of getting advantages with the authorities. Let me focus a moment on some of these things. They didn't change their name. They didn't change their language. Well, unfortunately, we in America, even the Orthodox Jews, we actually have secular names and don't speak Hebrew. But there's a larger point here. If somebody is an apikoros who goes around eating treif and is mechalel Shabbos and doesn't have bris milah and has no avodah zarah but goes by the name Rafi, why would we consider that to have any special spiritual significance at all? What's the point? I remember living in Chicago, there was a kosher-style restaurant that was open on Shabbos, and every Shabbos they had a sign serving cholent. What's the point of eating non-kosher cholent through Chilul Shabbos that you have to pay for? And the answer is, there is a point. Because when a person says, I am a Jew, when a person says, I want to identify with the destiny of the Jewish people, that is not the end all of redemption. You know, when you see that Federation sign, let my people go, we sometimes forget the second half of the verse, the Avduni, so that they will serve me, to be sure. But we have to understand that if something is not the end all, it is a foundation. The Jewish people could not be redeemed unless there was a sense of unity, a sense of achdus, a sense of togetherness, a sense of mutual respect and concern, to empathize with one's sufferings and to rejoice in one's joys. There was no potential for Geula until that was there. You know, the Washington Post had an article a few weeks ago, which would be very, very funny if it wouldn't be so sad, that there are two Jews in Kabul, Afghanistan, just two Jews that are left, and neither of them talk to each other. They are in a state of machlokas. There's a machlokas who is the custodian of the synagogue in Kabul, and they actually lit two different Hanukkah menorahs in opposite sides of the shul. Two. It's the old joke about the desert island that had two shuls, and there was only one person there, and he said, that's the shul I used to daven in. All too true. So we have to ask ourselves some very difficult questions. And again, both Rabbi Ziffer and Abba Cohn addressed it very, very eloquently. The Torah says, and if you're a religious person, you read this. Women at least read it once a day. Men read it morning and evening. The Ahavta Es Hashem Elokecha. You should love God. And Chazal interpret this to mean, you shall make the name of God beloved in the world. The Ahavta Sheyehei Shem Shamayim Mis'ahev Al Yadecha. That when people see us, they should say, if this is what a Jew does, if this is what the Torah teaches, Kama Noyim Masav, how beautiful this is. Kama Masukin. Now, what is a secular Jew or a non-Jew supposed to see that's so beautiful? That we only buy glad kosher meat in Chalav Yisrael, as important as those halachos are? That's not what is going to make them see the Torah as beautiful, because they don't see a significance in that. And the obvious point is, what makes it so beautiful in the eyes of someone who's a little distant from the religion is the Derech Eretz we show, the family lives we lead, the types of children we raise, the respect and the kindness and compassion that we show others, the good morning that we say to a secretary or a janitor or people who we might think aren't so important in the hierarchy. I'm not talking about political interests. I'm normally talking about working with the leaders of the community. I'm talking about the everyday countless interactions that we experience in the supermarket, that we experience in the streets, that we experience in our doctor's offices or our church offices or wherever we're going, or Amazing Savings, or wherever we happen to be. Again, just to repeat, all of us are ambassadors. And if a person says, who am I? If somebody once did something that wasn't so proper, the Chafetz Chaim said, you know, for a Talmud Chacham, that's a Chilul Hashem. And the person responded, I'm not a Talmud Chacham. Believe that you are. And that is, the point is that yes, we are representatives. And just to talk about the fact, you know, I remember years ago I was giving a shiur in Colombia, and a woman spoke to me afterwards, and she prefaced her remarks by saying, I'm not as religious as you. And then she went on to talk whatever she wanted to talk about. And my response at the time was, who says you're not as religious as me? Maybe you're more religious than me. I may keep some mitzvahs that you're not yet doing. But maybe you treat your parents better. Maybe you speak less Lashon Hara. What is the meaning of religion? What is the meaning of mitzvos? What is the meaning of holiness? There are, of course, mitzvos bein adam l'makom, and there are mitzvos bein adam l'chaveiro. All of us are imperfect. How do we look down at others? We can reject ideas, but we can respect the integrity of a person who is sincerely searching for the truth, even though we believe that their search might be misguided and they may be going in the wrong direction. And I will tell you that if we convey that sense of unconditional respect for the person, then we will find that they will respect us as well. And this is the wisdom of Shlomo HaMelech that says, "Kamayim hapanim el panim," as water reflects the face that you show the water. I smile at the water, I see a smiling face. Kein leiv ha'adam ba'adam, the heart of a human being will reflect back that which we give. If we consider others to be inferior to us, if we consider others not to be worthy of the good things that they do in their lives, then they will think the same thing about us, and maybe they'll even be justified. Because after all, if all human beings are made B'Tselem Elokim, then everyone is made B'Tselem Elokim. We have to communicate that. That's why, to go off a little bit of a digression, any type of chinuch that incorporates elements of racism or disparagement of others is a chinuch that we have to ruthlessly uproot. It has no place in a Jewish Seviva. We should talk about the beauty of Torah, the beauty of Yiddishkeit, the pride in being a Jew, and the joy in being a Jew, to be sure. But that doesn't have to be the expense of disparaging others and conveying those types of attitudes. And if one examines the lives of Gedolim, one sees how attuned our Gedolim were to the innate dignity and respect that they gave everyone. When Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was nifter, and apparently there was a convent across the street from his home in Muncie, there were yeshiva boys who were walking, and of course they bumped into a nun in full habit, and they just tried to walk around her or cross the street. And the nun stopped the boy and said, "Could you tell me where is the old gentleman that used to live here?" And by that time, Rav Yaakov, of course, you know, was nifter in Baltimore. And the person was so surprised, he said, "Well, he passed away." And she said, "That's so sad, because he always used to say hello to us and ask us how we were doing." You can rest assured that most of the Orthodox Jews in the area probably did not respond that way. Rav Simcha Wasserman, a woman in the Silver Spring area, had written me a letter criticizing something that I did, and she was trying to contrast it with Rav Simcha Wasserman, and she said something which was such a poetic statement that I think it's worthy of repeating, where she said she knew Rav Simcha Wasserman although she was a Mechalal Shabbos, and she said she knew that if the Torah would ever be forgotten from Klal Yisrael, it could be reconstructed by just watching the way he lived his life every single day. A living Sefer Torah in terms of the way he behaved towards everyone. Rav Simcha Zissel said about Rav Yisrael Salanter that the reason Darwin was led astray and believed that mankind descended from apes was because he never met Rav Yisrael Salanter. If he would have met Rav Yisrael Salanter, he would have known only God could have made such a creature. He couldn't have come from an animal. So, when we read the Art Scroll biographies, we read about Gedolim who knew Shas at the age of 4, and they did Yerushalmi by the age of 5, and Shulchan Aruch 400 times by their bar mitzvah. And that's all true, and that's all impressive. But that's not too much of a lesson that we're able to incorporate necessarily, because that's so far beyond us. But if we look at their sensitivity, which is also indeed beyond us as well, but at least it's something we can try to emulate, that sense of respect, that sense of kavod. What does kavod mean? Rav Shimon Shneur Hirsch writes that the etymology of kavod is to be weighty, significant. When I show somebody kavod, it's not a matter of opening the door or, you know, being polite. It's a matter of looking at the other and seeing them as significant, as weighty, as having something to contribute. And when we show that kavod, we're building bridges that can indeed bring us to the ultimate geula. And this is something we need to be very, very careful about. You know, Rav Huttner writes that there are two basic structures in Judaism. There is the Ark and there is the Mishkan. And the difference is, what is the Ark? The Ark is the hermetically sealed environment that you construct to prevent the torrential waters and raging floods from coming in. You create the ghetto which protects you from all of those destructive influences out there. And a Jew needs to create a teva. But Rav Huttner says the teva is not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is Mishkan, a tabernacle, a temple. Because if the teva keeps the bad stuff out, the Mishkan is a radiation of light and holiness that from the Mishkan goes outwards. Baruch Hashem, we are trying very hard, although we're not totally successful even in that, to try to create the Mishkan. We're not that successful. There's a lot more to do because there's so much out there that is indeed destructive. But perhaps we also have to work paradoxically and somewhat contradictorily at the same way to try to create that Mishkan that radiates outwards. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik used to describe sometimes the attitude that sometimes frum Jews have, that I'm better than others. He compared it to a housewife who bought a cat in order to destroy the mice. The housewife and the cat share a commonality of interest. They both hope if there are mice, the cat will pounce on them. But the difference between the housewife and the cat is the housewife would much prefer there be no mice, and the cat would be very disappointed. because by finding something that it can pounce on and rip up, the cat gets a lot of satisfaction. Rav Chaim says, sometimes we look at others and we get a certain perverse satisfaction in fact, looking at ourselves and saying, gee, I'm better than them. We're like the cat that wants to have that mice that rips up. Rav Chaim says our attitude has to be very, very different. We have to look at others with love and with concern and with care. And in the sense of kamayim hapanim el panim, like a face reflects back that which you show the water, so too they will see that we will make the name of God beloved in our hearts. That people will say, people should say, kama noyim masav, how pleasant, how beautiful is the life of a Jew. Will that make them from? Not necessarily, and that's not even the goal. Chazal don't say necessarily to make people from. But what impact will it have? You never know. Maybe the person's child may go to a day school because of it. Maybe there won't be an intermarriage. Maybe l'dorei doros. Certain things will be done because of that encounter. You know, again, I remember reading that Rebecca Kamenetsky, when he was in a doctor's office, and there was a non-religious 8-year-old there. Rav Yaakov took a ball and started throwing a ball with him. And somebody asked him, like, why is the Rosh Hashiva doing this? He says, he should remember that an old, you know, rabbi once took the time to play with him. Who knows where that's going to go? So as I say, these are not big things. But as many Gedolim have remarked, to a great person, nothing is small. It is the small things by which we create the greatness that we are capable of achieving.
Very much for your presentation. You've really given us a lot to think about. I'd like to open up the floor now to any questions that anyone might have to ask any of our panelists. That I would like to ask, and I guess you can decide who would answer this. This is something that I've been thinking about. We all know the Chazal, that Esav son of Yaakov. And I'm wondering, should one always assume that this is the case, despite the best of circumstances, that there's some underlying hatred for us? And how are we supposed to respond to that? What should our assumptions be? Is it really as hopeless as it sounds?
Well, again, I think Mr. Cohen is more capable of addressing it than I. I just want to say that Ronald Reagan used to quote the old Russian proverb, trust but verify, which means to say that I think, just in my limited experience, I've met many non-Jews who seem to be more or less people of goodwill, but you have to be careful not to push them too much, not to demand too much, not to expect too much. When there's a commonality of interests, I think we can work together. But one recognizes there is a gavul beyond which you cannot go. I actually was at a meeting last week with the Archbishop of Washington, Cardinal McCarrick, and he was nice enough to conceal his crucifix so it wasn't visible at the time. And he spoke very, very warmly about growing up surrounded by Jews in Washington Heights. He had mentioned that his doctor was Jewish, and he knew no Protestants growing up, only Catholics and Jews. And, you know, again, and Abba could speak to this better than I, of course there are issues of common concern. And I think if we don't push things too hard, we can have a working relationship. I think what Chazal or Merames do is, though, that at a deep, deep existential and spiritual level, there is an unbridgeable gap, and we just have to be careful not to dig too deep. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we can have an accommodation.
Mm-hmm. I would add to that. I'm often asked, have I ever experienced any expression of anti-Semitism in my work? It's probably the question most often asked of me, and the answer is no. People are not that silly, of course, but I've never detected any kind of open expression of anti-Semitism. What's interesting, though, is that in my relationship with other Jewish groups, I have often encountered the argument that if we have if we were stricter on church-state separation, or if we had implemented some of the other issues that are important, then I mean, if there would have been a stricter division between church and state, let's say in Nazi Germany, then we wouldn't have had a Holocaust, and or thing arguments to that effect, and that's why we have to be so vigilant here. And my response to them is always, well, if that's what you think, then you don't quite understand the essence of anti-Semitism, and that anti-Semitism is deeper than the trivia and the minutia of politics and legislation and things of that nature. It's something I think, as Rabbi Breidowitz suggested, it's deeper, and it's not something that we necessarily deal with in an open day-to-day basis. What's interesting about anti-Semitism also is that we're perceived, especially by, again, conservative religious groups. When I say we, and again, this goes back to who is we, I mean, the larger Jewish community, as I mentioned, we're striking at some of the very core issues of heartland America, school prayer, things of that nature. We have to ask ourselves whether that causes anti-Semitism, whether that contributes to anti-Semitism, whether that, you know, in some way brings out the ace of Sonias Yaakov. And it requires the larger Jewish community, I think, to reevaluate a little bit, and it requires us to decide whether we should go into coalition with these groups to fight these kinds of things, to fight these kinds of battles. And again, it's a very delicate kind of thing. I know within the Aguda, and I only mention the Aguda because I know it, every single coalition that we are asked to enter, every single one, whether it's a non-Jewish one or a Jewish one, has to be approved of by the Motzis Gedolei HaTorah. And it's precisely because it needs to be evaluated. You know, yes, we have common concerns, but that's not enough. That's not enough for us to go into coalition with other groups. There are other issues lurking, and one of them is the concept of Esav Sonias Yaakov, and how does that play into the equation? Thank you.
Yes. The question is, sometimes people are approached because of what they have seen other Orthodox people appearing as. Maybe it's just a visual type of thing. The example is given as a woman going to the supermarket, and she's dressed as though she were at home in her tichel and her robe and is not presenting herself well. And other people ask us, what is this? Is this what it's all about, and what does this mean?
Early on in my career, as I was just learning the ropes of being an Orthodox Jew in a very non-Orthodox environment, there was a terrible, terrible division, split, amongst Hasidim in Brooklyn. Two different Hasidic groups were literally at war with each other over some petty issues. And the stories that were coming out daily were fodder for the mill in the non-Orthodox community. People loved to tell over these stories, old men being hauled off in a van on one street, you know, and then rolled out of the van on another street with their beards plucked out. These were Hasidim doing this to each other, you know, and I was troubled by this. Went to a Rebbe of mine and asked him, what is a person supposed to say? What are we supposed to do? After all, if this is the system that we subscribe to, and these people all supposedly, they shuckle when they daven, they do all the right things, they eat glatt kosher, chal of Yisrael, shouldn't they be practicing some other midos tovos among each other? And his response to me was very simple, but something I never forgot, and that is, don't judge the system by people who presume to speak in its name. What you have to do when people challenge you about the Orthodox world and what they see as the inconsistencies, Rabbi Breidowitz alluded to this, is take a look at the majority. Here in Baltimore, anybody have an idea how many Orthodox Jews there are? Now, the number is not an easy number to pin down, but I'll tell you, it's approximately 20% of the number that we consider to be the overall population of Jewish Baltimore, which means that there's somewhere between 18 and 20,000 Orthodox Jews. Now, human condition is such that of 18 or 20,000 Jews, you're going to find a few of them who are inconsistent in their behavior, and they're going to do some things that embarrass the rest of us. What you have to do is you have to redirect people's attention to the amount of good that goes on, to the midos tovos, to the mostos that take care of people, to the incredible system that goes on within the Orthodox community of people taking care of each other, watching out for each other, and their integration of their religious life and their social sensitivities. And then you have to say, you know, and that's the way of the world, especially in a modern society where people have all sorts of sometimes it's psychological lapses, sometimes it's temptations that they fall prey to, and it's our job, the rest of us, to be vigilant and to find those problems and to try and isolate them and repair them when we can. But you have to be able to stand tall, and you have to be able to say, we're very, very proud of our accomplishments. Our tradition is a tradition of 3,300 years, which we know has preserved us and that has enabled us to maintain our identity and the kind of high esteem that we're held in the eyes of most people. The kids are nimrats. You should know, by the way, that when I lead discussions, presentations with young adults, with young leadership groups, and we talk about ethical decisions or the nature of how a community makes its decisions, this is the issue that comes up over and over and over again. Because here's an example of where we tend to draw the lines and create pictures that are black and white, when the real world that we live in is a world of gray. Now, I want to just take you on a journey for a moment, and I want to explain to you the view of a non-Orthodox Jew who lives in Owings Mills, who works hard, who supports his or her synagogue, who participates in the community, gives a fairly generous gift to the Associated, participates in some other community activities, member of a committee or a board of some different organization, works hard 5 days a week. This person says, you know, I have 2 days a week in which to use the recreational facilities of the Jewish community that are out there. And I'm asked to pay several hundred dollars a year to maintain my family membership in the JCC. And I would like to be able to go on Saturday afternoon after I leave my temple. I'd like to go to the JCC, and I'd like to be able to go there to be with other Jews and do things on Shabbos. And what the Orthodox Jews in Park Heights are saying to me is, no, if you want to be with other Jews, go to the mall, or go to the movies, or do something else, but you can't come to your Jewish organization that you support. Now, that's not the way the dialogue went. In the Orthodox community, we had a knee-jerk reaction. It was our solemn responsibility to make sure that the line is drawn here, that we have no compromise on Chilul Shabbos, and that the community standard is that our buildings are closed, and that standard has to be maintained at all cost. And so what we had was children in our yeshivas writing letters to the president of the JCC and the director of the federation, letters saying, if only you could come to my house on Shabbos and see how beautiful it is, then you would not want to sin by opening up the JCC. I'm not going to side here in front of this group on which way the vote should have gone. I'll just tell you two things. The Orthodox community did not have a healthy debate over what might have been the options in this issue and what would the price be for winning the issue, which we did. But what we also have not done is sustain the Kiruv work that we promised ourselves we would do. We said, Bavon Husseinu HaRabim, Ashamnu Bagadnu, we are the ones who are responsible because we should make Baltimore a more conducive environment for people to love Shabbos, and then they wouldn't want to open the JCC. And the change between now and 4 years ago when this issue first came up is minuscule. Maybe in a few instances there are individuals who have created new relationships and sustained those relationships, but by and large our institutions, we're doing Kiruv work, but we're doing it on our terms. We want you to be like us. And I think that the issue, the non-Orthodox community had fairly little opportunity to hear the real concern of the Orthodox community. What they heard and what they saw was what I call the tyranny of the minority. I want you to understand, in their eyes, religious Jews who don't live in their neighborhood, who were not going to be affected whatsoever, were preventing them from opening up, quote, their JCC in Owings Mills. So my reference to that was simply in cultivating that ability for us to see the world through other people's eyes, not necessarily in terms of getting to a conclusion, but how do we work our way through the issue and conduct ourselves and comport ourselves during the process.
I just wanted to add one thing. I remember very well the demonstrations, and I also remember the tenor of the speeches spoke very highly about how we love the non-religious and we're doing it for them. And frankly, I have to say that I'm very, very disturbed. I felt it was almost a fraudulent statement to make. I don't think that was the primary motivation. And as Rabbi Ziffer said, there has not been a carry out from that. So just something to be very, very aware of.
Yes. Very well, very lovingly. It was not done as an admonishment. It was done lovingly. And everybody did turn out for this. We had a great turnout. And I just found that there was a lot. I did hear a lot of favorable reporting from the secular side. Plus, I have a problem with this whole presentation of one thing. Basically, if Das Torah is one way, and Das Torah is that I don't think that they didn't just want Shabbos groups. All they would have wanted in the JCC was the Kirche groups. It would not have been a problem. They wanted to use the pool. They wanted to use the sports equipment, and I'm sure the candy machines, whatever there, and it would have promoted the little Shabbos. And what we, my problem is, we want to be nice. We want to. I was in here also, but I think there's a certain line that we can't cross. We want to be nice to you. We want to validate you as human beings. We can smile at you. We can say hi in the supermarket, which I always do. But on the other hand, Dr. Torres says, Kilul Shabbos is utter. It's not our convenience. We just have to draw the line and not allow it in a JCC. Maybe in the Reform Temple, if they want to have their groups or whatever. So I think it's less simple than has been.
Are there any other questions? I saw a few. Do you want to respond?
Okay. Just a quick response. Chas v'chalila, don't think that I'm suggesting that an issue like this is simple. But I'm going to suggest to you to try and avoid other simple things. Let's not fall into the trap of saying, according to Das Torah, you can't open a JCC on Shabbos. Das Torah is Das Torah. That's a whole lecture and discussion in itself. And we have to be very, very careful about falling into simplistic matrices of decision making. The fact of the matter is, the JCC proposal was filled with Shabbos atmosphere, Shabbos conduct of the JCC. How would people get there? Okay, that's a problem. But what I think is the debate never took place. The rally was wonderful. The rally was a Kiddush Hashem. No question about it. But what I'm saying is, I don't think the Orthodox community in that incident, it's a wonderful case study and we should unpack it, we should discuss it and explore it. The Orthodox community did not engage in the exercise of trying to see, A, what are they really saying? B, how are they viewing us? C, what will the outcome of this be? Will it be the enhancement of Torah? Or will it be the degradation of a Torah view because of the way in which we're communicating? Again, I'm not speaking to what the outcome might have been or should have been. The outcome was that the community has maintained its standards and institutions are not open on Shabbos. But I think how we get there and how we comport ourselves along the way in this discussion are very important. Again, I think that, you know, this is not a discussion about the JCC. It's a wonderful trigger issue for this kind of an issue because it's such a paradigm for interaction between the Orthodox and non-Orthodox community.
Yes.
Pinchas, who of course exemplifies what is called kanos, zealousness, is described as ben Elazar ben Aaron, and the Mefarshim talk about why is he connected to Aaron, who was his grandfather, and Rav Chaim Shmulevitz explains that Aaron's mida was oev shalom barodev shalom, a lover of peace, a pursuer of peace, and he said, in order to be zealous and firm in your commitment, you also have to be a person that is a lover of peace. To be a Jew is to walk on a tightrope. On one hand, we have to unconditionally believe with a great passion in the mitzvahs of Hashem, in the Torah, in right and wrong. We don't compromise on that definition. And at the same time, live a life in which we embrace with respect and with love, really, everyone that we come in contact with. Now, the problem is, in a generally educational system, you can take one of two approaches. You can kind of be a true believer, which disparages and rejects those that are not exactly the way you are, or you can be an Oyev Yisrael type, which is, I'm okay, you're okay, and degenerate into moral relativism and ethical subjectivity. I remember once attending two Shabbos Shuvah drushes before I had to give one, in two different shuls. One was what you would call a very Haredi, black hat shul, and the message there was the importance of Shmirah Shabbos. And then I walked into a more modern Orthodox shul, and the message there was Avas Yisrael and to be friendly to people. And I thought to myself, it would have been a wonderful idea, maybe, if the Shabbos Shuvah drushes were reversed in the two shuls. This way, each one is hearing what they hear, and they simply think, oh, I wish that other shul, you know, would get the message. And it is a very, very difficult balance. You know, it's a question many people who are Balei Tshuva have issues, you know, do I let my children spend time with their grandparents or their aunts or their uncles? And these are very, very difficult issues. One should talk to a Rav or a Posek or an advisor about them. All I know is there has to be a sense, and you see this from the Gedolim, that of the chashivas of human beings, of a sense of respect, of a sense of looking at their good points, focusing on that which is good, and at the same time indicating that there are certain things that we don't emulate. It's not a question of people being bad. It's a question of they haven't found Shabbos yet, or they haven't found Kashrus yet. They're not yet Shomrei Mitzvahs, but we also have to admire them and pray for them and look at the good things that they do. It's a very, very difficult balance. It is. And that's why we tend to veer, depending on the school, to one extreme or the other. But the truth is you have to have both.
The issue that you raise obviously is an issue for everyone, and in our homes is the place where it starts. I could tell you that in my home, the word Schwarze is not allowed to be used. The word Goy is not allowed to be used. I just give those two examples as a way of, in a sense, not only trying to instill values, but also battling what my kids are hearing outside. The I've approached this question, and maybe this is really what, along the lines of Rabbi Breidowitz mentioned. I refer to it as the fe theory. The fe. Don't ask me how to spell it. In other words, anything that's not me is fe. If you're going to be a day school, we're going to be a cheder. If you're going to go till 4 o'clock, we're going to go till 5 o'clock. And you see this not only in school, but you see it as the children get older, whether it's seminaries, whether it's shidduchim, whether it's lifestyles after marriage, whatever it is, it's whatever's not me is fe. You see it among the yeshiva light from the different yeshivas. And it goes from within the Orthodox community to outside the Orthodox community, or within one version of Orthodoxy to others as well. And I think, unfortunately, part of it is bred in the yeshivas, in the day schools itself, day schools, elementary schools itself, and reinforced in homes. And you know, it's a tragedy. I mean, I think it's the biggest problem we have in our community, other than paying our tuitions. But at the same time, this notion of whatever is not me is fe, and whatever I don't do is fe, is something that I think is a priority for us. I mean, we know we talk about, you know, we've got varts from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and others about, you know, there are different degulim, and we all have our place, and we all have our function, and we all have our role, and we all contribute to Klal Yisrael. And yet there's a disconnect between that thinking, which I think is true Hashkafic thinking, to what our kids are hearing, to what our kids are living. And the tragedy is, I think, that sometimes we in our homes have to counteract what the kids are hearing, not only in school and in other homes, on the street. And I'm going to stop there.
Can I just tell you, this is a very short story, I think, that's really illustrates this perfectly. I knew a fellow who grew up in Virginia, totally assimilated, and he came to Eretz Yisrael to go to college, and he became a Gerer Chassid, totally extreme, with white socks and a shtreimel and payas. And he got married to a woman in Mea Shearim, and I happened to have been in Eretz Yisrael at the time. And I felt a little out of place. I was just wearing a black suit, etc. And his parents came from Falls Church, Virginia, and they thought this was the Twilight Zone. This is was totally, everyone speaking in Yiddish, and etc. And the chasen and the kala were separated like a mile apart. They were in different halls. But they got together for Sheva Brachas. And everything was in Yiddish. But at the end of the wedding, the boy, who was wearing a shtreimel and payas and a beard, got up and he spoke in English, and really only a few people understood. And he wanted to thank his parents, and he said that 90% of what I am is because of you, and the 10% that isn't is because you gave me the courage to find my own way. So the concept was that he had come from an environment that was totally different than what he became, but he still acknowledged that there were real strengths, and he was trying to build bridges and not using his tshuva and his Yiddishkeit to cut off those connections.
I wish we had time. We've come to the point where we are going to have to stop the panel discussion. I want to thank all of you very much. This has been very, very interesting. I have only one announcement that I never like to make because I never like to hear, but please, if you have a cell phone, either put it on vibrate or turn it off. I know that there's sometimes you just have to have it on, but try to accommodate everyone else's sensibilities, and let's try to keep them off. I will encourage you to move quickly to the workshops. If you have questions about where you need to go, please check with someone.